a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
With the governor's office. Just a reminder for those of you on the phone to mute your lines by pressing star six and to unmute during the question and answer period by pressing pound six. And a reminder for everyone in the room to use the microphones at the table. And with that, I'll turn it over to the governor.
Thank you, Kelsey, and thank you, everyone, for joining on this conference call and here in Pierre, those of you here present. I want to begin the press conference today by talking a little bit about Medicaid. As I'm sure you all know, earlier this week there was a teleconference among the legislative leadership of both parties and federal representatives from Health and Human Services in Washington about the letter I had sent and my request that we get some indication whether they might consider a formal waiver application along certain lines. And I guess I must say I was disappointed that the indication at this stage, at least through those on the phone, was not to support that kind of a waiver application. I think it's important to recognize that I still don't have a response directly from HHS on this matter. I think it's also interesting that the conference was arranged through intermediaries, and sometimes conversations like this are exploratory and not necessarily definitive of the ultimate outcome or decision. That being said, I don't have any unrealistic expectations, but I do think it's important to remember that no response has yet been made and no direct conversation has occurred, nor any letter response. And I think when I get that letter response, then we'll have a definitive answer, and until then, we really don't know with certainty. Otherwise, I think the legislative session is drawing to a close now. We've got just a few legislative days that bills may find success or failure, and then the final 3 days will be defining the general fund budget and the fiscal year 15 budget, and also conference committees and concurrences. So things are coming to a head, especially in the financial arena here next week, and I'm looking forward to concluding those matters. With that, I'm open to any questions on any matter.
Governor, were you on the phone call with the legislative leaders and the federal officials?
I was not. Deb Bowman of my office and Kim Malsom-Risden, who just moved into the position that Deb is retiring from here shortly, they were on the phone.
Based on your understanding of that, that would appear to make it nearly impossible for anything to happen during this legislative session regarding Medicaid expansion. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's fair. I think it's unlikely we'll get anything in time to do anything. But I guess one doesn't know with certainty. The legislative session doesn't end until next Friday, so we've got another 10 days or so.
The legislative leaders, on the Republican side anyway, said they still have some hope that the federal officials in the next few months might take another look at this and decide maybe some kind of waiver would be acceptable. And if that's the case, they would expect you to call a special session. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's possible. I think, again, this is a dynamic situation. The federal government continues to adapt their posture. Just yesterday, I know the federal government posted information on their website to indicate that states who had created exchanges that were not functioning well and whose citizens had gone on to the state-run exchange and been unsuccessful in signing up for subsidized coverage when they should have been entitled to do that and should have been successful. When those citizens went out into the marketplace and directly purchased from an insurance agent a policy that they could have bought on the marketplace if the marketplace would have been functional, the exchange, if the exchange would have been functional, the federal government said, even though the law says subsidized coverage will only be available to those who purchase through an exchange, they nevertheless posted an announcement that they will subsidize those policies that were not purchased on the exchange. So I think it's another indication, well, just one more example in a string of many examples where the federal government has departed from the letter of the law and is enforcing it with some variability, and that there is, in my mind, just as much room for granting a waiver, in fact, maybe more room, because there is a formal process under which waivers can be granted. So I think there is potential down the road that the federal officials will take a look at this proposal that we've put forth and support it. We'll see. In that case, I guess to answer your question in the second part, in that case, I would call a special session of the legislature, because we would need to amend the general bill to permit the federal fund expenditures and then some state fund expenditures that would be necessary under such a waiver.
Kathy, SDPB. So assuming that, you know, you get official word that they're not interested in our potential waiver and nothing is done through the legislature next week, what will happen to those then that don't qualify for the, you know, 100 to 138% subsidized plans? You know, what will happen to the 0 to 100%? And can you describe what kind of people those are that fall into that category?
Well, they're all adults. Children who are at any incomes up to 200% are covered by either Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Plan. So I think it's important that everyone recognize every one of those persons who is in that category that would be covered by the expansion is an adult. They're not disabled. They're not frail elderly. The group that represents this 0 to 138%, according to the economic impact study that the South Dakota health providers themselves commissioned, and these South Dakota Healthcare Association, this group, they are very much in favor of the expansion. So this isn't the other side. This is the side in favor of expansion. They commissioned an economic impact study, which, by my reading, tells us that about almost two-thirds of those people are already insured. And I think it's also noteworthy that that same impact study does not include, if I read it correctly, and I believe I am, does not include Native Americans living on the reservation who are covered by Indian Health. So that would raise that percentage up still further. I think it's also important to remember that those who are at the 100 to 138% in that range, they are today entitled to go on the exchange and sign up for subsidized coverage, and the subsidy is pretty healthy. Again, for those at the in the range of 100, 101%, 102%, all they pay is 2% of their income. And if they're a very low income, that's 2% of a very low number. So I think during, if Health and Human Services says no to our letter, then I think it's important to recognize that those in that 100 to 138 range will increasingly be going on to the exchange and signing up for subsidized coverage, because the disincentive in years past, if you think about it, in years past, they may have had a pre-existing condition that prevented them from signing up, or most of them would say, I can't afford it. Even if I don't have a condition, I can't afford it. Well, the I can't afford it is no longer there. And in fact, there may have been disincentives to improve their economic lot, because most of our safety net programs either go away after you hit certain income thresholds, or the benefits are reduced as you move up your income. In this case, your incentive to move your income up above 100%, because suddenly now there's a great incentive to do that. You gain health insurance at a very modest cost to you. So what I'm hoping will happen is we'll see many people in South Dakota's relatively strong employment economy, we'll see many people work to get themselves up above that 100% level and get health insurance that they have a little bit of their own dollars into. Most of the dollars would be federal dollars. And I think it's noteworthy that the health providers will receive a better reimbursement rate under the private insurance. So if I break my leg and I'm on Medicaid, my doctor doesn't get paid as much as if I break my leg and I'm on private insurance, because the private insurance claim rate payments are higher in virtually every category. So that's what would happen, I think. Those are some of the things that would happen.
Governor, just to clarify, you said that study showed about two-thirds of the people were already insured. What income range was that?
138 and below.
Okay. Not just 100 to 138, but
no.
Okay.
That's the way I read it, and I read it pretty carefully because it was interesting to me.
I'll move off of Medicaid expansion. There has been reports of a lawsuit being filed against the Army Corps of Engineers for the flooding. What is your reaction to that lawsuit?
The Lieutenant Governor and I had a conversation about the theory behind the lawsuit, and I think it's interesting. I think it's a high hill to climb. I'll be surprised if it is successful. You have to be able to demonstrate that when the Corps created the systems of dams and channelized some of the river, that it was foreseeable that this flooding would occur. And I think unless you can achieve that initial threshold, then the suits don't proceed. So, but I don't blame them for trying. If everybody's got equal access to the courts. Courts are open to all.
Just to follow up, I saw a report that the Army Corps thinks that the snowpack levels are about the same as they were during the 2011 floods and stuff. Do you think that if they decide to do another, flooding of the area, that might have an impact? Or what are some of your concerns if snowpack levels continue to rise?
Well, I think we have to remember there's the prospect of flooding is really governed by five major factors. First, mountain snowpack. And I think what you're hearing is the mountain snowpack is very, very strong this year. It's large and very comparable to 2011. Second factor is plains snowpack. And we don't have a good measuring system for evaluating snowpack. The measuring sites are fewer and further between and less reliable. In fact, you might remember that is one of the things I harped about during the flood and in the aftermath of the flood. It was one of the things that the committee that was formed to look back and say, what could we do better? One of the things they said was have more plain snowpack monitoring stations. And I went so far as to say South Dakota would participate in the cost of those, because we believe it's important. Now that's still in the works in the future, but so we don't really know as much as we'd like to know about plain snowpack. We know some. Thirdly, storage. How much storage is in there, particularly in the three large dams, Oahe, Garrison, and Peck? So we look at those three storage, and we're actually in a little better shape than we were in 2011. And then the two other main factors are in the future. What will be the wetness of spring? And you might remember we had a very dramatically wet spring, and we had rainfall events in the upper reaches of the watershed that were 5 and 7 inch rains over very large land masses, and so it created a lot of rain at the very time that the fifth factor was occurring, and that was the speed of thaw. We had a very cold March, and even into early April, it was still very cold. Then suddenly it thawed quickly, and so you had large amounts of that snowpack turning into water and starting to course through the waterway. And even though it didn't get here till May, it started with a very rapid thaw. And so the three factors, we know the mountain snowpack. We know a little bit about the plain snowpack, not as much as we wish we knew. Storage is a little bit better than it was in 11. The other two we don't know yet because the future isn't here yet.
Governor, Nate with SDPB, just a quick question. With all these bills, it seems like there's a lot of bills that seem to bring a lot of negative attention and those types of things. I guess I'm just trying to look at the opposite side here today, and I've talked to the Republicans and Democrats both, and what are some bills that you think are huge positives that you've seen come out of this year's session? And, you know, is there some momentum with some of these, too, that can even help improve things farther on in the future?
Well, I think most of the impact that is seen resulting from the legislative session is found this year in the budget bills, in the dollar bills. We're going to have a balanced budget, I know, again. And when I say balanced, I think it's important to recognize it's not just nominally balanced. It's structurally balanced in the sense that our ongoing revenue, the revenue we expect to be coming in on an annual basis, that's what we spend on ongoing expenses. And many states don't take that approach. They worry about this year, and we'll worry about next year when we get there. And so that's why you get into trouble in Detroit, in that city, why many states are borrowing. Illinois, South Dakota does not do that, and we're better for that. A major change this year, of course, is to pay down quite a bit of debt, and by paying down that debt, we free up a lot of ongoing dollars, and that's what's enabling us to offer, in my proposal, 3% increase to schools and 3% increase to Medicaid providers, almost double what they would normally get under the traditional and statutory frameworks, and so that's good. We're freezing tuition at the university system. We're freezing tuition in the tech schools. The tech schools really, I would say, in the last 2 months have seen lots of good news. The dual credit bill that will support high schoolers taking classes and getting financial support to get dual credit also at a university or tech school, where we spent almost $4 million on equipment at the four tech schools. We're proposing $1.5 million in scholarship dollars for the tech school, and of course we're freezing their tuition as well. Another bill that's had some recent attention that I proposed was the telecommunication services fund that is a couple decades old, but maybe it was being too restricted in what it could be spent for. And so some of the disabled community and some of the deaf community weren't really able to access the kind of equipment that today's technology makes available. And so I think that bill has found a lot of good support, and so we'll have folks with hearing impairment being able to use modern-day devices. And that's something I had personal interest because of my parents being deaf and seeing them. And I'm surprised there are still some deaf using these old TDDs, which are, they look like old computers, and they're essentially just big text message computers, and really it's silly in the age of the iPad and FaceTime on your iPhone and text messaging. We really should use that fund for modern devices so that those communication barriers can be brought down. So those are some good things, and I'm optimistic about most of them. As I said, next week we'll make the revised budget revenue estimates. We made those estimates last November and announced them in December, and we've got a lot more history now. And so we'll use that history and try to create a new revenue estimate, and then we'll see what spending it allows.
Are there any questions on the line?
Governor Tony Mangan at KCCR.
Yes.
A couple quick questions. Regarding the Corps of Engineers, I talked to the Corps today about the snowpack issue.
Yes.
And they are monitoring and they're getting involved. One of the things that you and other governors wanted in 2011 was more of an update from them when things started to maybe get to a point where it could get serious. Have you had any conversation with the Corps of Engineers at this point that they're at least watching this issue? Have you had any communication with them lately?
I have not had direct conversations with them, but excuse me, my staff has. And so we're watching this, and we're, of course, very sensibly aware of what an impact it had on us in 2011, and so we want to be sensitive to whatever early warning we can get. Again, as I said, the three factors we have some sense of. There's a couple factors that are in the future yet, and so time will tell. But we are watching it.
At this point, you're not getting any indication, am I right, Governor, that this could be as serious as 2011?
No, not yet. It's too early.
And then one other quick thing, a political issue. You've always said that you would announce your reelection campaigns or your plans after the legislative session. Given the fact that the filing deadline comes before the end of the main run day, your veto day, are we expecting to see something in the next week or so?
Yes.
An official announcement?
Yep. It'll be very soon.
Is there any hint to that?
Well, it'll be with...
Which way you're leading?
It'll be before veto day, and I'm still planning to run.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.